Hello everyone, it's Shahid here from The Creative Floor. Today is a slightly different podcast in the fact that it actually isn't a Creative Floor podcast. It's actually a Healthcare Comms podcast. Harry Brooker from Healthcare Comms got in touch a while ago and wanted to have a chat with me. So in the spirit of helping out and co-promoting their podcast, we're uploading it on here. So please do subscribe to Healthcare Comms. It's available wherever you listen to your podcasts. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks for doing this, Harry. It gave me an opportunity to do a podcast without having to edit it for once. Please do enjoy this. This is called When Harry Met Shahid.
Welcome to the Healthcare Comms podcast. I'm your host, Harry Brooker. This podcast is all about learning and listening from some of the most experienced and knowledgeable people this industry has to offer, delving into the minds of some of the most successful professionals in healthcare communications. We'll be covering different topics each week that you can learn, listen, relate, and most importantly, implement into your day-to-day working life. We'll be talking about the very first moment our guests ever heard of healthcare communications up until this very day and everything in between, bringing to life the true wins, true failures, and true successes of healthcare communications. This podcast does not reflect the opinions of whom my guests work for, but are the guests' personal opinions and experiences throughout their career.
Today I'm joined by Shahid Perret, who is the founder of the Creative Floor Healthcare Awards, alongside the Executive Creative Director at Publicis Life Brands. How are you doing today? Are you all good?
Yeah, good. Yeah, very good. How are you?
Good. Yeah, good. It's been, because obviously I sort of bulk record the sort of podcasts. So I think it's my third podcast today. So I've been sort of speaking. Yeah.
Today?
Yeah. Yeah, today. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not exhausted.
So, yeah, well, yeah. It's. I just like to do everything in bulk, and just like to get everything there. So, hopefully, by the end of next week, we'll have about 26 weeks worth of content done. So, one question I sort of like to ask as a little bit of an icebreaker. Obviously, I sort of know you anyway, but just for the sort of people listening, how did you end up in the world of healthcare advertising or healthcare communications? Because I always find that quite interesting.
Yeah, like most people, just complete fluke. You can hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Like most people, just accidentally. I didn't really ever think it was an industry. I mean, I'd come from a consumer background, so my first agency was it was a BBDO office, Abbott Mead Vickers. Yeah. I had worked on a few over the counter medicines, but things for like piles, Germaloids, I think it was at the time, and for Thrush. So we worked on a few Bayer products, things like Caniston and deodorants and stuff like that. Anyway, it just so happened that I just got called up one day for a job at Langland, which was a healthcare agency out in Windsor, and that was my first exposure to pharma, really. I mean, it's the sort of closest analogy I sort of share with people is that it's a little bit like Hogwarts, like it's completely invisible to most people. But when you get there, you realize it's just massive. It's just a huge, huge industry. And, the money that's sort of spent in the States. But there's a lot of opportunity to do some really great work and magic, if you want to call it that. So, it was just a complete accident, just over 10 years ago now. But and I've sort of say this openly to my friends who are still working in the consumer world, those who are still working in it, I'd never go back to consumer type.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no way. I'd rather pick up bins, if I'm totally honest with you. I'd rather do something completely different. I just couldn't think of anything worse. No one needs to eat another Mars bar. Do you know what I mean? No one needs, I'm not, and fair play to anyone who does work and love that world. I'm not saying they're bad people. It's just not for me anymore. I had my hit of it, and it was great experience, and I learned so much. But there's just more to do in health and pharma specifically, because I think most people who've got a vague interest in advertising and its history will have known of all the amazing the creative revolution in the advertising world, you know, that happened in the 60s with the likes of Birnbach and DDB and pioneers like George Louis and, you know, Helmut Krohn. There's some amazing people that started the creative revolution back in the 60s that transformed the way advertising was approached. And you know, advertising has had its creative revolution and its change, and it is still evolving on a year-to-year basis. But I think healthcare over the last 10 years is having its creative revolution in the same way the consumer industry had in the 60s. So yeah, it's such a great place to be right now, because there is so much change from a creative perspective, better ideas, better talent. And yeah, so why would you not want to be part of that? And why would you want to go into an industry that's already had its revolution, you know? Mm. So
how did they sell it to you? Where's home for you? Because obviously if you're living in London and someone calls you a job, you know, about a job in Windsor, what do you do? Was you living there, or was you commuting there?
So I lived at the time in King's Cross. Wow. And so anyone who sort of doesn't know the distance, it's really, really far. So King's Cross is bang in central London, and Windsor is outside of London. So it was about a 3-hour commute there and back on a good day, you know, that's without all the delays and stuff. But that wasn't really a barrier, because it was just new. It was just a different thing. And I think it just felt very strange, because, you know, I thought I was quite averse to the industry back then. I just thought, well, I know all the agencies, I know all the major brands, I know what's winning awards every year. I was very much, well, so I thought, quite knowledgeable about the industry and who heroes were and who the icons were. But for somebody just to open the door or a different curtain, if you like, and go, look, have you seen that over there? And it was just like, well, I've never seen it before. It felt weird. It was almost like, you know, if you could go back in time, if Marty McFly just turned up in his car and just went, should we go back 20 years and see what we can do, knowing everything that you know now? And it felt a little bit like that at the time. And that, do you know what, even to this day, it intrigues me. Being in health and pharma, I still haven't lost that mindset, because there is still so much to do within it. It still hasn't quite reached its potential in terms of where it could be and what it could be doing. So I still have that sort of, I don't know, excitement. Maybe it's a bit overclaim, but there's certainly that element of, it still feels like I know a lot more just from my past experience that health hasn't quite picked up yet. But yeah. So yeah, that was it. That was the only reason. It wasn't, you know, as creative people, it's all about the work. It's not necessarily about, well, certainly when you're younger anyway, it's not really about, you know, having a life or whatever. It's just about making great work. And yeah, it just intrigued me. So that was the reason. Distance really wasn't, or the commute wasn't a barrier. It was just, I just found it interesting.
Mm. Going sort of off topic on healthcare communications or advertising, do you think that the consumer world have hit a limit in terms of what they can and can't do? Like, you can only go so far with a Mars bar, or you can only go so far with the, you know, a Lynx shower gel.
I don't know. I don't think so. No. I mean, I guess there's no limit to great ideas, right? No, it's a good question. I mean, I guess you'd get a different question, an answer from different people, but there is no limit to an idea or great ideas, regardless of what it's for. It was just my own personal take is that I just don't find working on things that don't help people not that interesting for me. Do you know what I mean? But equally, there are lots of people who think that people need to eat more Snickers in the world, and that's totally fine, as long as you can entertain people and maybe even make them smile in their day or whatever, then that's fine. I mean, I love Snickers. I eat Snickers whenever I can. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm currently getting back to Snickers ice cream.
Oh, so, those ice creams are something special, aren't they?
So, of course, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just my personal take. But yeah, no, I don't think there's any limit to ideas. I think where the industry is really struggling at the moment is, well, it's a lot. I mean, because, you know, people aren't consuming ads in the same way as they were 20, 30 years ago. I mean, whatever the latest stat is, I don't know, but the last one I read was 70 to 80% of people have ad blockers, you know, on their desktops or laptops or whatever. So it's just a sign of the time that, you know, advertise, no one's looking out for your ad. No one cares about what you've got to sell. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, a lot of brands just haven't really got that. They'll spend months and millions of pounds on market strategy and market research, and the execution tends to be just something that's just really easily ignored. And so the return on investment's not quite there. I think no one's really quite cracked yet how people really want to engage with brands, you know. Yes, I don't know. I think there's a lot of flux at the moment, and there are a lot of people out there who can and are coming up with different ways of selling products or selling services and advertising agencies, rather than setting the trend of how that can be done. They're almost playing catch up, and they're sort of chasing other smaller people, agencies and organizations that are creating the future.
I think I was listening to your podcast with Tom Richards. Actually, he runs the Creative Floor podcast. If you guys don't know, go and check it out. Some great stuff on there. But he I think he was at a consumer, and I think he was working on Auto Trader, and I think that account was worth about like 12 million quid. And I was just shocked. I was just like, that's so much money for a car buying and selling platform. That's like a lot of money to sort of do on that. What would people actually do with that in terms of, if Auto Trader gave you, you know, chuck 12 million quid at you, what would you do with it? It's quite a hell of a lot of money.
Well, what would I do personally with it?
No, obviously.
I'd have a very big lunch. Yeah. I mean, that's what I'd do.
What do you actually do with that money? That's like a hell of a lot of money, like to you know, on something like that. Like for me, just as an outsider.
Like all brands, right? You're going to have to work out what the business success factors are. What are the, you know, what are the targets for that year? Is it 1% growth? Is it 10% growth? Is it 50% growth? Whatever it is, and work out how that money can be utilized to achieve it through creative means or in brand building or whatever. So, I mean, yeah, 12 million is a huge amount of money for. I mean, maybe he got that figure wrong. I don't know. I mean, you know what creative people are like. It's all the same, isn't it? 10 quid, a million quid, 20 million, it's all the same. I guess that sort of goes back to some of my sort of earlier point. I think a lot of agencies are in flux right now because a lot of clients are really wondering where their money's going. You know, I mean, there are a lot of layers, a lot of people. There's a lot of expensive and buildings. And yeah, I don't know what Auto Trader spend nowadays, but maybe it's less, maybe it's more. I don't know. But in the end, it's how you see that 12 million quid. It's not 12 million quid that's just going to be burnt away. I mean, in the end, that 12 million quid is meant to maybe get a return of 50 million quid or whatever. I mean, I can recall my days back in Abbott Mead Vickers, where the agency would always create some like stats for potential clients. So I remember one of the stats was for every pound Walker's Crisps spent. So Walker's was one of the big clients there. For every pound Walker's spent in the agency, they'd get £30 back.
Wow.
So I guess it's how you see that 12 million quid. So if you got 30 times your return on that 12 million quid, that 12 million quid doesn't seem like a lot of money anymore, does it?
No.
It's just how you see that money. I mean, I don't think Tom was saying they got 12 million quid and they just had like massive parties and just basically wasted it. It's there as a tool, isn't it, to basically fund the growth of the organization and growth. Good advertising will sell products off of a shelf, but great advertising will build factories. I mean, that was always the thing that we were told. So there is a level that creativity can have on a business. It's not just doing it for the sake of making a few people happy because they've got a creative outlet. It's you know, the better and the greater creativity that is associated with your brand and how you approach selling it will always inevitably give you a greater return. And that's the point. So Yeah,
for sure. Okay, cool. So obviously you was at Langland just over 2 years. How were your first 2 years? Good, bad, ugly, massive shock?
like a bit of both, because I was learning, you know, I hadn't, I'd come from a consumer agency and health was completely new to me and I was completely new to them, you know, equally. So I guess they taught me a load. I mean, they taught, I mean, I still feel like I know nothing within health, honestly, even I've been in it for so many years and I can understand a few of the acronyms and all that sort of stuff now. But yeah, I mean, it was just a massive learning experience. And what was really great about it actually was I'd worked in a couple of independent agencies as a freelancer, but it was my first full-time independent agency. And just the difference in culture comparing an independent to a network was, again, another learning experience for me and something that was really great, actually. I must, even though I work in a network now, I definitely preferred the independent of it, because it felt a little bit more intimate and it felt like you weren't just a number. And I don't mean to say that I feel like a number where I am now, because I think one of the things that, you know, one of the nice things about experiencing both corporate environment and a more independent environment is that you can take the benefits of both of those aspects, and I'm in a position, thankfully, to bring as many of those benefits to where I work now. If that makes sense. Time just flies nowadays, doesn't it? So 2 years, it's almost like a distant memory. It's almost like I can't even remember a lot of it, because it feels like lifetime. Well, it was a lifetime ago, but it was a great experience. And I made some work that I was really proud of, and I made friends for life. And, you know, I think one of the things that I've learned is that wherever you work, you're always going to have good days, you're always going to have bad days. But in the end, whenever you leave a place, the only two things you ever really take away is the work and the friends that you make. And everything else just goes away. Like, you know, all those meetings that you had or disappointments with clients or whatever, all that stuff always goes away. So the friends and the work have sort of remained from those days. And I also met my wife there too. So that was interesting. I think a lot of people, an interesting thing about Langland, not a lot of people know this, is that quite a lot of people meet their partners there.
Yeah, I did see something the other day where I was like, oh, okay, like maybe you two are together. There's definitely been a few. What does she do now? Does she still work in this space or not at all?
My wife?
Yeah.
Well, she was a designer. She still is a designer, but she freelances. So, but we've got two little kids now, so she's sort of busy, like looking after them while I'm talking to you, and working and such. But she does. If there's any freelance work that's interesting, then she'll take it. But she'll only do it if it's interesting, and if it's not interesting, then she won't do it. But she does a lot of my she does a lot of the creative floor stuff. I keep her busy with that. So
I was going to talk to you about that. It's good that you sort of brought it up. So Creative Floor Awards, how long has that been going? It's been going for
seventh year now.
Tell me a little bit about that for people that don't know. I'm sure a lot of people do know, but just tell me a little bit about why you started it. And
well, I've been in the industry for just over 10 years now, so you know, when I joined it, again, I was so naive to it. And what I didn't But the reason why I was so naive to it is because a lot of the work that was generated in pharma advertising at the time had never really made its way into the normal consumer award shows, such as D&AD or Creative Circle or Cannes even at that time. But what it did have was it had its own award show. So it had, you know, something called the IPA Awards, which was a really big thing back then. Unfortunately, they're not around anymore. You've got like the Clio's, you know, so the Clio Awards, very famous advertising show. They had their own health equivalent, at the Globals, at the PM Awards, and loads. And again, I'd never sort of heard of most of those award shows other than the Clio's. They were all new to me. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be really, well, quite successful while I was at Langland on the awards front. But for me, I just felt that the standard of stuff that won in the healthcare bubble back then, I'm talking over 10 years ago now, I'm not necessarily talking about today, but back then, it just wasn't as good as what was winning in the consumer award shows. And so, like most creative people, when you turn up to a judging panel or you turn up to an award show, everyone just, I mean, creative people love to moan, and I love to moan with the rest of them. I love it. You know, everyone does it. It's just a creative outlet. Everyone loves to moan about why everything's so bad and it should be better and all those sorts of things. And as much as I like to moan, I also like to do something about injustices or stuff that needs to be changed. I'm not one of those people to just wait for somebody else to hopefully do something about stuff. So I just thought, well, why don't I try and elevate the way that the work is being judged? And because unfortunately what happens, and that happened, it still happens to an extent today, is because healthcare advertising is still a relatively small place to be.
Yeah.
Everyone pretty much knows who everyone is. So you've got the same old people in agencies in the same roles, and those people essentially just get recycled amongst all the different award shows. And there's nothing wrong with that, because there's some really amazing talented people, but I just thought that if you just brought in different perspectives, you know, from outside of the healthcare bubble, it might be a way of A, exposing the sort of briefs and the work that we have as an industry to inspire people to come into it, like I was, mm-hmm. and to also elevate the work too. I mean, you know, for example, you know, turning up to, you know, award shows and seeing, you know, seeing pieces of work winning best digital pieces or best app or whatever, a lot of the work that you saw, it was very uninspiring. Mm. So I just thought, well, wouldn't it be just amazing if you got somebody from, you know, San Francisco who just built up a $1 billion tech company to give a perspective to see what they think about some of that work? Or if you're judging some film craft, why don't you bring in some Hollywood directors and get them to see what they think about it? Because again, it's just all about elevating the standard of work. And the other perspective was, I was fully aware that there are many, 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 many people behind each piece of work. Mm. You know, it's not just about the creatives, it's about the account team, the planners, everyone. I mean, it's the clients even. And I just didn't think that there was much of an opportunity in the award shows back then that really celebrated talent and people. So yeah, there were sort of two areas that I thought were lacking at the time. And I also thought that the amount of money that it costs to enter these awards and attend these awards, crazy. I mean, what are they actually doing to actually help the industry find better talent? What are they doing to address the diversity issue? I mean, you know, we're sort of in a week where George Floyd's, you know, I think it was yesterday, George Floyd's funeral took place. So, you know, everyone, you know, now all of a sudden, you know, everyone's the diversity agenda is back and that, all those sorts of things. But, you know, as I sort of said on a previous podcast, you know, no one turned the racist button on last week. You know, this has been an issue since I could remember. Mm-hmm. And when I came into the industry, it's been an issue. I mean, even if you look at recent statistics this year, you know, 92% of people who work in the UK advertising industry are all from privileged white middle-class backgrounds. Mm. There's nothing wrong with being white or coming from a privileged or advantaged background, but 92% is an issue. And even if you go over to the States, you know, a recent statistics this year will tell you that 120 million people in the United States of America do not see themselves reflected in their advertising. So, you know, this has been an issue since I can remember. There is just not enough action being, you know, taking place. So if I sort of bucket those three areas that I could see in front of me were just empty. You know, no one was doing anything about celebrating talent. No one was doing anything about elevating the work and getting different types of perspectives on that work. Mm. And no one was doing anything to help agencies tackle diversity or help underprivileged people come into the industry, because there is a huge amount of talent out there that has got no idea what we do. And secondly, they've got no means of taking that raw talent and doing something with it. Mm. So that was, they were sort of burning, you know, sort of things that were burning and bugging me in the back of my mind. And I just thought, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is, you know, I'm going to give it a go. And if I don't, you know, if it doesn't work out and no one wants to support this, then quite frankly, everyone can just shut up and stop moaning about stuff, because I'm going to give it a go. And, you know, we started off in a very small way. yeah, everyone thinks they can run an award show, and I can tell you what, it's only until you actually do it. It's definitely not as simple as people think. It certainly wasn't as simple as what I thought anyway back then.
Yeah.
There is a huge infrastructure behind what is essentially a simple model, but there is a lot that goes behind it, and there's a lot of organization, and there is a lot of money if you're going to do it well. And I hopefully 7 years on, we've got to a place where we do it well. First year and second year, we were just learning, really making loads of mistakes and doing things that we would never do now. But that's just part of that's just everyone's journey on starting anything from scratch. And that was it. So luckily, you know, the awards have been doing, you know, really, really well. And we've raised, you know, over, as of last year, just over £80,000 that's gone towards helping underprivileged people and more diversity into agencies. We're not going to change the industry overnight. We're not certainly going to do it on our own, but what we are doing is just trying to be the example of all the things that I said. And I think, you know, we, out of all those three aspects, I think we're doing a really, really fantastic job. But it's only because the industry is supporting the award show, and it, by the industry supporting the award show, it's a signal that the issues that were an issue to me 7 years ago are still issues that are fundamentally important to our industry. So our industry does acknowledge that there are these issues, but that equally they are supporting the award show, which means that there are signals that things will hopefully be getting better.
Fingers crossed. I mean, it's definitely been on the tip of everyone's tongue for a long time. But obviously when we're recording this, George Floyd's funeral, which was yesterday. I'm not sure when this podcast is going to be released, but hopefully by the time this does get out, there would be some more sort of structure in place and just like a new rule book, but just a different perspective on things and people. And
yeah, absolutely. And you know, we all need hope. And I think what the creative floor offers is that hope, you know, that we're never going to be finished, but there is so much. I'm just from the contacts that I've made outside of Publicis and via all the charity work and via the creative floor and all the things that does, there is so much going on right now and there is so much hope. It's just that we've all just got to accelerate it a little bit faster, and just rather than sort of put it as, you know, the fifth or sixth thing on our list of things to do, just make it number one. You know, that's the thing. In the end, you know, diversity of thought and diversity of thinking can only make work better. You know, it's imperative to creating better work. And so, yeah, I think there's a lot to be hopeful for.
I think it's weird how obviously restrictions are getting lifted on COVID-19. And I think, just bear with me on this one, but I think if COVID didn't happen, George Floyd potentially wouldn't have lost his job, which meant he wouldn't have been out on the streets, which wouldn't have caused this massive eruption, which then wouldn't have caused stuff to be made apparent right now. And I think with everything that's gone on, it's just fast forwarded everything, like a lot of stuff that needed to be fast forward.
I mean, I haven't heard that perspective, so I'm not saying it's not right. Or I mean, the honest truth is I don't know. I mean, I think there was a Will Smith quote that I saw the other day, which I think basically summed it up perfectly. Yeah, exactly. Racism isn't getting worse. It's just getting filmed. No, so
I love that quote. That is a very big quote.
Yeah. And I think it goes to sort of my earlier point too, where, you know, no, the racism button didn't turn on with George Floyd a couple of weeks ago. And yeah, maybe if he hadn't lost his job, and maybe if he wasn't in that particular shop at that time, that thing wouldn't have been filmed and these things wouldn't have happened, maybe. But the point being that racism is still going on.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And who's to say something else wouldn't have been filmed with somebody else and all those sorts of things. So maybe you're right, but the issue has never gone away.
Oh no, yeah, totally agree.
And that's the thing. So something else undoubtedly at some point would have sparked off, you know, these protests or whatever, because it hasn't gone away. And it's not only just started, it's been happening for most people's existence. But, you know, look, there's always hope. There's always something that we can all do as individuals, no matter how small that might seem at the time. But we can all do something to make one person's life better. And that's something to hold on to.
Massively agree on that one. Fingers crossed. I really do hope I see something change. I don't know what it is or how it's going to be done. And I think it's very new. A lot of people need to come together and not necessarily agree on this is what needs to happen. But I think it's just a conscious effort and willingness by everyone. It's not just going to come from the big corporate companies. It's going to come from everyone. Whether you work in, you know, whether you're unemployed or, you know, you're one of the richest people in the world. I think it's got to come from everyone about learning and sort of educating. Because I was listening to your podcast on this subject actually. It was Natasha.
Oh, what, the racism one?
Yeah, really, really good. And I listened to a comment she said, and I've done this. I've been guilty of it in the past. Where someone said to her, "Is it systematic racism, or
systematic
racism?" And basically, it's someone said to her, "You know, can I touch your hair?" And I thought first off, I was like, "That's not bad." But then I thought about it, and I thought about it some more, and I was like, if I was in her shoes, or let's say, for instance, I was in Kenya, right? And the people come up to me, oh, look, you know, let me touch your hair. Like, it's like, you know, fuck off. I'm not a, you know, doll, a performing monkey. You know, like go away sort of thing. And I would feel very, very uncomfortable in that situation. And that's what I think people need to learn on about it, is like, you've got to put yourself in people's shoes and how they would feel, like, if you just got to put yourself in a situation they feel that they're in. And I've done it with my friend. He's, you know, he's got a massive afro, but we used to plait it and, you know, do all sorts to it and stuff, just because it was there, and he had like one of the biggest afros in, you know, in our sort of neighborhood. And it was quite fun. It is definitely a new learning curve. And I think some of the stuff that's been brought to light is very interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing where.
But what you just said was really cool, I thought, and interesting. It's just taking a situation that you don't think is initially an issue and then just flipping it. And you know, there was this thing the other day I saw in the States where you got, you know, whatever, thousands of protesters all kind of walking down the street, and either side of the road were basically armed police. And every one of those police officers were white. And one of the things that I read on the sort of Twitter trail was, okay, well, now imagine all those white officers were black. And all of a sudden it looks completely different. And, you know, even when you look at most organizations where the majority of, you know, lots of brands are now saying, you know, we support diversity and we support Black Lives Matter and blah, 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 blah. And then people are then going onto those organizations' websites, and then they're putting up the images of the board, the people that run these organizations. And, you know, 99%, 99% are all white. And then you're saying, well, what's going on here? And then you just have to flip that. Now imagine they were all black. You know, the moment you start, to your point, the moment you start flipping it round, then you can really start seeing where the problems are.
It's definitely a weird one. And it's almost like, I just thought of something there, because my friend used to sort of get it, and whenever we would sort of go out and about, and this is such a good, I'm so glad I thought of this right now, and we always, you know, go out on a night out and whatever, and he's, you know, his name's Reynold, really, really nice guy. Like, he's lived in England all his life, and his mum's like very strict African lady. And whenever we go on a night out, it's one of the first questions he used to get asked by girls when he was trying to chat them up: where are you from? And it's again, flip it in your shoes. If you was out and about in Tokyo, or, you know, in Papua New Guinea or Philippines, and every question you got asked is, where are you from? Like, you know, and it's, he didn't have it. He had an English accent, didn't really have an accent at all. But it's just, it's just that continuous, you know, like, what, why do you have to say that? Like, it's just too much, and it's almost like people see it as a as a diluted version of what it is. But it's like, sure, it's just like when you're getting, you know, small stones chucked at you, you're not going to notice. And people only chuck tiny stones. But if you imagine all those tiny stones chucked at once, or like gathered together, and all those, you know, those stones are comments, they build up in your head psychologically. And then, it's just a sort of snowball effect from there, really. Obviously, the sort of podcast took a bit of a divulge, but is quite an interesting one, actually. I do like talking about that, and hopefully, when this gets out, it would be, you know, some sort of stuff would be, you know, relevant, I guess. So obviously, we you know, come on the podcast to talk about what is good creative, and it's, for me, I was really interested to get you on talking about this, because I know a lot of people know you, and you're almost like a creative factory in terms of what you can just sort of spitball, produce, and sort of think about. And it's not necessarily making stuff look pretty. It's, you know, the approach and the activities that you're doing. In your eyes, just tell me a little bit about you and your sort of creative journey, and what makes creative stand out for you, do you think?
Maybe this goes back to what I said earlier, right? In terms of when I came into pharma and what I was seeing, you know, it was a big industry, but it was very untapped. You know, the potential hadn't necessarily reached, a creative revolution hadn't necessarily started. I think we're in it now. Mm. And when I made the statement of I'd never go back into consumer advertising, I think it's because there's so much to be done within the current communications industry that we're in, and you know, my sort of remit, wherever I've been actually, and until I think I've done it, or there's nothing left for me to contribute, will be the day that I step away from the industry. Mm. But you know, it's for me, my personal goal, my only purpose really of staying in this industry is to make it better. It's to take what, you know, has been done to death and done badly, you know, a million times over, and just flip it on its head and so it's almost like looking at the industry, taking a scalpel to every single aspect of it and cutting it out and replacing it with something better. So, I mean, I can give you loads of examples. So I won't bore you. You just let me know when it gets boring and I'll stop. One of the things, again, but you know, 8 years ago or so, one of the things that was quite apparent as an opportunity was how stories are told within healthcare. So, you know, there are amazing stories around people with conditions, illnesses, cures, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I kept seeing about every story I kept seeing was a talking head. So you saw talking heads at congresses, you saw talking heads on websites, you saw talking heads on, you know, PowerPoint presentations. They were so boring. And there was this misconception at the time where everyone's saying, you know, well, if you're emotionalizing the data, you have to see people. You have to see, you know, the color of their eyes. You've got to see their hands. You've got to see their mouth. You've got to see the people who are associated with those stories. Now, the story is always fantastic, but from a creative perspective, they were just really dull and really flat. And so one of the aspects that I wanted to change was just that. It was, you know, the fact that you think emotional stories have to be connected to the person telling them and done in such a boring talking head way was something that I wanted to prove wrong, basically. So one of the pieces of work, I'll just refer to some of the work that I've been connected to because I can, and then I'll try and share other stories from other agencies too. We were working on a schizophrenia brand, and you know, the brief essentially was, we've got 15 minutes worth of talking heads, and can you just cut them down to 2 to 3 minutes, and we'll play them at a congress for healthcare professionals so they can sort of get behind the data and really see the impact that it can potentially have to people. Yeah. And we sort of took a snippet. We found a story of a dad who was basically talking about how his son had been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and it was just the decline of this poor soul in his life. And it was just pretty very powerful, but visually very uninteresting. So we took the story And we kind of were working out, again, another aspect of creativity, I think, which is something that is getting better in our industry, but certainly back then, I'm talking 8-9 years ago now, was very misunderstood in terms of art direction. Just that is a principle, that is craft. So if you speak to most people about art direction, you know, they'll just say, well, it's just making things look pretty, isn't it? It's just, you know, making it yellow or making it blue or sticking Gotham, you know, in 14 points or whatever. But it's not actually. Art direction is, how does the visual tell the story? How is the visual integrated within the story that you're trying to create or to connect to? I mean, I'm summarizing for you here. So we took this story and it was like, well, what, how else can we art direct this piece? And it was a story of light. It was a story of darkness. It was that, in essence. We sold in this idea of a black and white animation, and it's called The Boy I Used to Know. And you can Google it. You can go on YouTube. It's there. And we created this film. And one of the success measures that we had against this was, it, you know, we want people, when they attend this Congress, they're going to be in a room with 50 other competitors and other brands spouting out similar data points, and they will all have their equivalent of emotionalizing the data with some form of talking head. So we want this to be the one thing that you're going to remember when you get on the plane going home, and we also want people to cry and all these sorts of things. And, you know, during that whole process of creating that piece, I witnessed about at least three people cry in front of me when they watched it. And, you know, it was a moment in time where it not only was it a really nice piece of work that we were all very proud of, but it elevated the story. I mean, when you contrasted the talking head of the actual father talking, it was hugely powerful. But when you compared it to how we art directed it and took it in a different space, it lifted it up by at least tenfold, without a doubt. And we, you know, we even shared it back with the father whose story it was. And, you know, he cried when he watched it, and he was so moved and touched by the piece of work. And it was something that he was never going to throw away. And he was going to show to his friends and family just to explain to them his experience and his journey with his son. And it was just a great piece of work. And it was a moment in time where, okay, we didn't do it for awards, but it won loads. I mean, it won every healthcare award show going. It also got into DNAD, so it got into the consumer arena, and it done very, very well. But the great thing about it was that, you know, I had many, many, many creative people come up to me, many creative directors come up to me saying, you know, I can't tell you how many times, from other agencies who said, I can't tell you how many times we've shown that piece of work to our clients to get them to think differently and create these stories in a different way. I mean, that was 8-9 years ago. Today, it's just a given. You know, you get a story, you get a perspective, you get a talking head. People recreating those stories into animations is not an original thing anymore. But at the time, it was the first thing that the industry had seen. And I believe it was one moment that did change the industry for the better. So that was one example. I think there are many different aspects that have been torn up. You know, even I'll give you another example. You know, I was always told that copywriting in pharma could never match the emotion or the storytelling of maybe consumer brands, because it all had to be embedded in science, you know, too many sort of acronyms and terms and all these sorts of things and data points that could never allow the craft of copywriting to be on the same level. And it was, you know, is one of those buckets that we were very conscious of as an agency to pick apart and prove wrong. And shortly after The Boy, we created some series of films. We call them slam poetry. And again, they were for a hardcore pharma brand, and it was for congresses, and it was a whole platform to basically explain to doctors what words to look out for when you're asking questions of somebody who's experiencing this skin condition. It's the sort of principle of when you say, hey, Harry, how's it going? And you go, yeah, I'm fine. You might not be fine. You know, your arm might have just been chopped off, but your initial reaction is still going to be, yeah, I'm fine. And it's just when somebody tells you, okay, well, now you've got to ask two or three questions beyond how are you to really find out how Harry's really feeling. So it's the same principle that we were creating as a series of educational experiences, but to start each of those experiences in terms of talking about the different types of patients that they're likely to encounter. So whether it's pre-diagnosis, at diagnosis, and post-diagnosis, we created a set of films, and they were all based around slam poetry, and they were phenomenal. I remember the writer who came up with the idea, his name was Tom. You know, he has psoriasis. I'm sure he won't mind me saying this. I mean, it's not the condition that we were working on, but more or less some of the feelings, some of the frustrations that he was experiencing with his psoriasis were very similar to the skin condition that these patients were going through. And I remember when he read them out, I mean, he'd performed it. I mean, I didn't even see the script. He just literally said, I'll just read it out because it's probably easier for you to get where I'm coming from. And he read it out, and he wasn't shouting, but he was performing, and it was just frustration, but it was so poetic. It was so beautifully written. It was so wonderfully done. Mm-hmm. And we were like, yeah, let's do it. Let's present. It was one idea. You know, we had to present a very quick turnaround, and we presented it to the client, and they were like, yeah, I'm not quite sure what I'm buying here, but yeah, it sounds great. You know, we sort of made it, and they were so powerful. And I still stand by this today. I don't think there's anything that's been as beautifully written that's gone out there into a pharma audience as beautiful. And, you know, again, we didn't, believe it or not, we didn't do it for awards, but it won everything. It just sweeped the board. And it was just one of those examples of, when you say great copy can't be written, you know, in this space, we just play you that. People will always say, well, no, it's different when you're writing for consumers or you're writing for patients, because, you know, you can speak in their own language, and that's where you can get that craft and creativity. But this was two healthcare professionals, and we communicated to them in poetry, in slam poetry. Do you know what I mean?
And
you've even got medics. I remember when they were sort of reviewing it, they were trying to change some of the words so it sounded more medical. And it was like, yeah, that's not poetry anymore if you put that word in. Or you go, doesn't quite rhyme the same, you know.
Yeah.
So they were just like, yeah, okay, all right, fine. So I'm not saying it was easy. It was extremely challenging, but we did it. And again, it was just a moment in time where you're looking at an aspect of the industry that is underserved. It's largely underserved, with the greatest of respect, through laziness, in my opinion, and just accepting that's just the way things are. So I think, again, you know, just going back to maybe some of the mindset that I have, when somebody says that's just the way things are, accept it. That's like a red flag to a bull for me, because I will do everything humanly possible to prove you wrong. You know, and I, you know, I'm just giving like two examples there, and I could bore you to death with loads, but, you know, there's still a lot more to do. And there are lots of agencies now in our space who are also doing this. You know, a lot of people are now looking at congresses, when congresses were a thing in a physical, you know, space before Corona, of not just pull up banners with images and headlines, but actually building really brilliant experiences where people would come and they would involve themselves in an activity or whatever it happens to be, to just to sort of actually start brand building. You know, I think the mindset still, and certainly was back then, is that a brand is a logo and a brand is an image of somebody walking over a bridge with a headline or a swoosh in the right-hand corner. And thankfully, there are many agencies now in the industry that don't believe that's true. But unfortunately, there's still a lot of that stuff being churned out. And it's just about us fighting it and just proving a point that there's a much, much better way of doing this. Because in the end, no one cares. Like, in the end, no one's looking out for your brand. No one cares. I mean, you just have to be self-reflective on your own experience. You are not logging on to Facebook to be sold to. You know, you're not logging on into Instagram so somebody can sell you paint or whatever happens to be. If you're not getting people's attention, you're not giving them a reason to care or immerse yourself in something they've got to say, you're dead.
How often are you sort of like, okay, you get a briefing and you look at that brief, okay, that's fairly similar to that, same concept, okay, yep. And then you go out and you find, and where do you get your inspiration from? Does it just come from within the team, the creative guys?
So in consumer world, you get given a brief to sell a Mercedes, right? Now, it's the easiest thing in the world is to go down and go, right, you've got to go and sell the new C-Class Mercedes. What you'd normally do is you'd go down to the garage, the Mercedes dealership, and you'd let them sell it to you, and you'd go and take it for a test drive, and you would work out all the different things that would make you buy this C-Class versus an Audi or a BMW. And you would just find those nuggets, you know, you would find the reason to believe, you would find the things that a Mercedes can only give you that a BMW can't, or an Audi. Now in pharma, it's quite difficult unless you've experienced a condition yourself, or you're in front of a patient, or in front of a doctor, or whatever. So one of the things that I, you know, when I, again, I can just recall my first, second briefs in healthcare, and I couldn't even pronounce the condition. You know, I remember one of the first things I worked on was something called hemophilia, and I was like, geez, I can't even spell it, I can't pronounce it, I don't even know what it is. How on earth am I meant to do anything on this? So, or hepatitis C, I remember at the time was another brief, and I was like, again, I was so naive. I was like, what is hepatitis C? What is it? Who gets it? What does this thing do to make it better? And, you know, because a lot of the times drugs don't necessarily fix the condition. They just sort of prevent things from getting worse or whatever. There's so many nuances. So one of the things that we always try and stipulate is actually getting into the product or getting into the person's life. And you know, whether that be pulling or going to somebody's home. Or I remember one of the sort of first briefs around the hepatitis C, the account team managed to get me some time at a drugs clinic in just off Camden High Street. And I remember going down there and seeing all these poor people just waiting outside. They're all heroin addicts or people in really bad places, basically. And they were essentially just going into these clinics to just get methadone or something of an equivalent and then going away. And I remember going into the clinic. And again, you know, I've been fortunate not to, you know, ever be in a place like that or have anyone directly close to me. So it was a completely brand new experience for me going in there, just the smell of the environment, you know, the sorts of people that were there, and then speaking to the healthcare professionals, you know, for 20-30 minutes to get an idea of what their day was like, you know, the amount of empathy that they had towards these people. And then, you know, within literally you've kind of got where the angle needs to be. So we, you know, have always kept to that, even, you know, working on HIV. I remember spending, you know, 3-4 weeks just talking to people with HIV and learning about the different types of communities that operate within this disease state. I mean, I remember learning that people in the UK, there are certain places where people go to get HIV. So there is such a thing as HIV parties. And because it's in some communities, it's seen as a designer disease, which is crazy. I mean, it's just mad. I mean, who goes to get sick on anything? Wow. But I mean, again, but then, you know, the flip angle to that is because the drugs today are so amazing, people know that they're not going to die. So all of a sudden it becomes like this fashion symbol for certain people to go, well, I know what it's like because I've got it. And it's only when you start delving in terms of the product and the essence of what the product's meant to do and the people that it's going to affect. And it sounds really weird, like, even, you know, speaking to many people and going into hospitals and clinics, just the smell, it sounds really weird, but just the smell of a place and the sense of a place in the end does affect the work that you do. Because, you know, you can dissect anything down in a really logical way if you want to, but when you're involved in something to the extent where it's a feeling, it just feels like this will connect, you just know. Do you know what I mean? So I think that's part of our creative process. But equally, I think it's utterly important to see what's going on outside, because there might be parallel industries that are approaching similar problems, but just in a completely different way. I mean, I can share one example. One of my old school friends, he's the co-founder of Calm, which is a meditation app, and it's worth, latest valuation was $1 billion. Wow. Now, you know, you sort of look at at what that company does, and you can kind of see where there are many parallels where you can bring in some of that software, and you can see some of the thinking and the insights that they approach to tackle certain issues around mental health or sleep, or dealing with children, or dealing with different aspects of people's lives, and how they utilize their product to help people. Now, there are many aspects to some, just again, another complete different industry of how they just approach product development in a really quick and much more efficient way than maybe big corporations do. And, you know, even looking at people's own journey, actually, even if you just took, his name is Alex, even if you take Alex's journey, he's a creative person. You know, he is an ideas person. If you ever met Alex, he would never say he was a marketer or a tech head. He would say he was a creative, and his whole experiences are exactly the same as many creative people, where, you know, constant rejection, you know, constantly being told your ideas aren't good enough, constantly being told to start again and start over and all those sorts of things. But even if you take his experience, you know, pulling it into the agency, you know, it helps. So yeah, going into the product is the first thing, but also going outside to basically get inspiration to how other industries are tackling similar issues is equally important, I'd say. But you need both, I think.
How do you sort of dissect it on the pitch front? Client comes in, you've got 5 days for a pitch. What do you do? How do you do it quick? Because it's great when you have time, but I think from what I've heard, I'm not sure if it's true or not, it's just that the industry is not getting enough time to do good stuff. How do you do it in a short period of time? Do you, instead of coming up with some crazy, you know, stuff we're going to do, would you rather just tell them the processes that you do and you give them case studies of what you've done?
If you've literally got no time, or if you've got 5 days to turn around a pitch, I think the worst thing that you could do is turn up to the pitch and say, here's the answer. You know, I think, as you say, it's like, look, this is what we've done in the past, and here are a couple of starters of what we've been able to turn around in the no time that we've had. And you try and keep it as open and as collaborative with the client as you can. Because let's, you know, again, to be frank, ideas are very personal. And one of the tricks of, well, tricks is probably the wrong word, and maybe selling is the wrong word too, but one of the best ways of getting good work out is when the client has got a personal connection to it. So that personal connection might be, well, they've been part of the ideation, or they felt that the ideas come from them, or whatever. And the moment you can get the client connected to the idea, to the point where they're happy to defend it and jump in front of a bus to protect it, you know, you've kind of got a really good chance of getting something really fantastic out. So yeah, I don't know, I think you'll get different people answering in different ways. Some people say, well, we've probably done it before in the past for another pitch, and we'll just pull out some old ideas. I never propose in a pitch that whatever I'm about to show them is ever the final idea.
Yeah,
because how could it be? And then that's the thing. How could it be? If the process that I've just spoken to you about is about getting literally under the skin of the people who are going to benefit from this product, or the people who are going to be prescribing it, you need that process. You just need it. So by not having it in an artificial pitch environment and sort of expecting to get the same result in 4 days or 5 days or 1 day, it's ludicrous. So I think as long as people understand your process and they like it and they want to be part of it, all you can ever do is to show them where you'd like to go with it and just a couple of thoughts. But yeah, I've never really believed in that.
You ever, this is just a sort of speculative sort of punt in the dark. And I'm not sure if it would be appropriate or not, but would you ever bring someone to a pitch that, let's say, for instance, you've done work for them and it's impacted their lives, just to give like a testimonial in there in front of the client? Have you ever done that?
You mean as a case study that we've done in the past, bringing that person in?
Like a literally live case study, someone there reading, you know, a testimonial or letting the panel ask them how you guys, you know, done it and what you did and, you know, the things you did and stuff like that.
I've never been in that scenario, but I mean, yeah, I guess the closest we've got to that is just sharing maybe people's own. I mean, I've shared my own personal experience with work that we've done in the past of how it's affected people that have been very close to me. So that we've only gone to that extent, but you know, back in the day, but you know, before Corona, most pitches were live in person.
Yeah.
And in our experience, you know, with our list of clients, we don't really work with many UK clients. So whenever we're having to pitch, it's always flying somewhere abroad. So I think it's just the practicalities of then bringing on an extra person to just talk for 10 minutes has never been that practical. But I think it's a great idea. It's not to say you couldn't dial somebody in or something to that effect.
Well, it's almost like a reference check.
Yeah. It's a different perspective as a pitch, because I think agencies can approach pitches in two ways. The first stance is agencies love talking about themselves. So they love talking about past projects and dwell about how successful they've made other brands. But in my experience, I think it's probably better to go the other way and just focus on the client in front of you.
Yeah.
And then focus on their specific challenge. Oh yeah, no doubt inspire them with and give them confidence with stuff that you've done in the past. But when, you know, a lot of pitches, you're only given an hour, you know, hour and a half at best. So that time goes pretty quick. So there's no right or wrong. I think it's just the experiences that I've had.
Yeah, for sure. And when obviously you're the sort of people you work with, you know, nine times out of 10, they're not based in the UK and you have to fly out. How are you approaching those? Obviously, I don't really know how we're sort of getting onto pitch and stuff like that. But how are you approaching, you know, let's say for instance that, you know, there's an account and it requires you to go and do some research in Thailand for a month. You know, what you could do in England, you know, you could go out and, you know, you could literally just go around, you could step out your Baker Street office and then, you know, go and talk to people and jump on the tube. But if you had to do that in Thailand, would you literally just set up in Thailand for a month and then just go and almost be like a journalist?
If the drug and the condition was specific to Thailand, do you mean?
Yeah, because I mean, each sort of culture, each city, each country, they have a, I'm not saying each city has a different way of treating stuff, but it has a different effect on different people. Heat, climate. In England, let's say, for instance, you had psoriasis, you can cover it up with a long, you know, t-shirt.
Yeah.
You go to Bangkok, you wear a long sleeve t-shirt and you're covered in sweat and it's just going to be making the psoriasis bad, I imagine.
I think you touch on a sort of Achilles heel, I think, because most agencies like ours, you know, we're sort of seen as the global team. And I guess, I don't know, maybe somebody will have more of an insight of how this has happened. But I think a lot of budgets in most big organizations now have been pulled from local countries specifically doing their own campaigns. And they're sort of pooling all that money into one and sort of giving it to a global marketing team to do something that basically fits all markets. But to your point, every market is going to have its own nuance and it's going to have its own issues. You know, Thailand is going to have different issues to the French market or this market. Unfortunately, I've never been in a situation where I've had to go to Thailand for a month to just sort of do a bit of research and some investigation, which I would love to. But one of the benefits of everything being online nowadays is that you can access elements of people's experiences and stories, just because it's quite commonplace now for people to share lots of aspects of their life. You know, even, I mean, we've worked on some really random stuff that I'd never heard of before, you know, and actually when you sort of start trawling through what people are putting on social media about their experiences, whether it be with mental health or whether it be with ALS or whatever it happens to be, there is a lot of information out there. So in, you know, when you can't go to a country and talk to people live, we've just sort of trawled social media and people's experiences and stories that they've just posted online. And I guess also there've been a few scenarios where we've been fortunate enough to call people. I mean, I remember we had a, you know, we were working on quite a big rare diseases portfolio And we were really, honestly, for months and months, I was really struggling to get my head around it because I hadn't connected to it in the same way as I'd given with the HIV experience and others. But we managed to find somebody in Canada who was living with this condition. And, you know, we were on a call with them for about 2 hours. Again, it wouldn't have been the same as just going to the house and having a cup of tea, for sure. But we called them up and it was mind-blowing. You know, the stuff they were saying, you could never make up. You couldn't even imagine it. And so there are ways of doing, there are ways that, you know, are you can get around it. But I will definitely be pitching for that month away in Thailand, without a doubt.
If you're getting under the skin of what it is you need to do, even from speaking to those people, it's not like just, you know, you're reading information that's written up by someone, you know, who's done an interview somewhere, you know, 5-6 years ago. It's actually going out and getting as much information as you can. It's almost storytelling. It's basically what it is. It's, you know, storytelling, I guess. And you can't write a story if you don't know much about the characters.
Yeah, well, the good thing about health is you don't really have to make too much up because it's all real.
It's quite an interesting one. Obviously, earlier on the podcast, we were talking about the sort of current affairs going on with George Floyd and stuff. And it's almost like one thing you sort of pointed out is how you as an agency, or, you know, this is your style. You know, if client gives you brief, you go out, you learn about that brief as much, you try and get as much information as that, you know, as possible before then going out and giving, you know, and basically just educating yourselves in it. It'd be really cool if that same principle occurred to people, like, look, there's a problem, go out, find out what the problem is, and then solve that problem for your own investigation and education. And you wouldn't be able to sort of maximize an account if you didn't do that investigation. It's the same with the stuff happening at the minute, you know, current sort of diversity and stuff like that. So at Publicist at the minute, then what's going on? Just a bit of an insight to you guys at the minute. How have you been coping with everything? Obviously, how have you managed to be creative with stuff? It's been a pain not being in the office. I know you're an in the office kind of guy, so
yeah. Well, I mean, everyone's well, which is great. Good. And from sort of health perspective, it's just so busy, which you know, is great considering, you know, the economic environment right now in the world where, you know, millions of people are losing their jobs and lots of brands are just disappearing off the high street and all those sorts of things. So, you know, we're in our little health bubble. Mm-hmm. And so we're, you know, I guess we're insulated from many of the sort of factors that are affecting much of the world right now. So, you know, touch wood, that's all really good. Yeah, so we're busy, and I think, you know, it's like 3 months now. It's like the third month working from home. I think everyone's adapted as well as they could and they can. Mm. My priority right now is just looking after everyone's mental state of mind. I mean, I predict that the mental health time bomb is going to be far greater than the lives affected by corona once this is all over. So, you know, we're all very conscious of that, and, you know, we're checking in with people and we're giving them as much space as they need, because let's be honest, there's a lot of stuff going on outside of our sort of healthcare world. There's, you know, lots of families who are, you know, partners are losing their jobs, or people are losing their lives because of COVID, and there's just lots of bad stuff going on. So, you know, we're all just trying to just be there for one another and just trying to be as kind and as patient as we can with one another. That's kind of as much as I can share in terms of my experience. I mean being at home is good for getting stuff done. I mean, it's really good, and obviously, you know, you save a lot of time on commuting and stuff. But if this is not ideal environment to be coming up with original or brilliant ideas, because at the agency we don't work in a traditional team format. We don't have art director, copywriter teams. We work in groups. So when we've got a brief and there's an opportunity, we've got 4 or 5 people kicking it around, and you know, you just miss a lot of those incidentals, and you just miss yeah, it's very difficult to replicate that, you know, on Zoom or Teams. You just can't. And a lot of the times the guys aren't even in the office when they're coming up with ideas. You know, they could be going to Regent's Park or they could be down the pub or they could be, I don't know, in a museum or anywhere. I mean, central London's a pretty awesome place, right? To just kind of be inspired and walk around and get lost and or whatever. So, and even as I said earlier, just meeting the people, getting under the skin, like it's very difficult to do that in the same way what we're used to doing it. And, you know, it's certainly not good for building culture, but the whole world's in this situation right now. So I don't know, I'm pretty grateful still that, you know, we're busy and we're doing our best, but it's really weird for me to say, but the creative output right now is not the priority for me. It's really just maintaining people's mental health and making that the absolute priority. I think, yeah, I don't know if that's the right thing to say or the wrong thing to say.
I think it's really relevant, like really, really relevant. My sort of personal experience, I've sort of pretty much always sort of worked from home. And yeah, it's okay for me, but it can get sort of very, very solitary sometimes. And I think if you're not used to it, like my wife yesterday kicked me out of the house. She's like, get out of the house. You've been in the house too long. Like, piss off somewhere. Just go for a drive, go for a walk, just get out. Like not in a horrible way. It's just like, you've just been in the house too long. And I can totally see where you're sort of coming from this. And, you know, luckily I'm up in Derby and it's not, you know, there's a lot of space and stuff and they've got, you know, a small garden and stuff and, you know, but there's people living in flats and stuff like that. And it's just, I genuinely just couldn't imagine it. Like, you know, if you've got a boyfriend or, you know, girlfriend or whatever, and it's you're there in a flat, the two of you both working from home, one bed flat, like I would just go literally insane. And I think this is stuff like this that you'll see in a couple of months, the sort of backlash of it. But yeah, it's what sort of cool things have you seen in the media or on the internet that you've seen? That's really cool. That's a wicked idea for the team, or stuff like that that you found's quite cool. I don't know if it's going to help people's mental health, but I saw, you know, like Google giving £1,000 to each employee to set up their home office a little bit better. It's just stuff like that that's actually cool, you know, like gift boxes. And, you know, gift boxes are great, you know, boost team morale, it's better than nothing, but, you know, it's not really going to help the arguments and fucking frustration.
Well, we've got something similar going on here where, because we're not expected to necessarily be back in the office if we don't want to until next year. So the group's sending everyone, you know, their old office chairs and screens and just things to make.
So cool.
So I mean, I can't wait to get my chair because I'm
amazing.
So I mean, I think there are lots of companies out there who are doing as much as they can do. Apart from that, I don't know what. I saw some really cool Chewbacca face masks. I know my kids want those. So, I mean, things like that are quite interesting, aren't they? You know, just the way that things are going to be from now on for quite a while. You know, when even little things like just wearing a mask was just something we used to see. You know, if you saw any images of people in Hong Kong or Japan or whatever, and you just thought, God, it's mad, isn't it? And people are now sort of looking at things like that and going, well, let's make them slightly more interesting then, and let's have a bit more art or creativity.
I saw one of the weirdest face masks for me. It was a see-through face mask, and it was really weird. Like, it's so simple. And it had the only bit that was see-through was the bit that was over the mouth.
See, was that for blind people?
No, that's
not blind people, deaf people. Sorry.
Yeah.
I think I saw that for deaf people, so people could still talk and they could still read their lips. I think that's what that was for.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well. Yeah. There we go. But yeah, I think there's some cool stuff that's going to come of it, but at the same time I think a lot of people are just craving normality and hopefully it sort of comes back soon. But I think I think on that note, I think we'll draw the podcast to a close. It's taken us down a lot of different paths. Have you found it good?
Yeah, I guess. I can't remember what I said. So, yeah, let's just say it was good.
Brilliant. All right, thank you so much for coming on, Shahid. I really appreciate it.
No, anytime.
Lastly, thank you so much for listening. I've been Harry Brooker. You've been the audience. And if you'd like to subscribe, please do, as it makes having to listen to my own voice in the editing process somewhat bearable.